Chapter 18. I, Nicholas Brady, understood that these primordial faculties and abilities had been restored to me only temporarily, that their existence in me depended on my relatedness to the communications web. Once I fell away from that again, the faculties and abilities would fall away too, and I would drop back down into the state of blindness in which I had lived up to now. That was how I felt as I sat out on the patio, reading with intense satisfaction and joy the information visible in the light of the stars. I had been blind up until now, and I would be blind again. There was no way it could be made to last, not as long as the adversary continued to live on our planet. And the time had not yet come for his removal. The best we could hope for now was to roll him back a little, a small defensive victory merely to stabilize our own situation. Only when the king breached through linear time with his armed host, all riding their great horses into battle, would the change be permanent and for everyone. The veils would lift, and we would see the world as it was, and ourselves as well. The help we were being given now consisted of information only. We were being lent Valis's wisdom, but not his power. The power would be given only to the rightful king. We could not be trusted with it. We would misuse it. That night when I went to bed, I experienced one of the most vivid dreams so far, one which made a great impression on me. I found myself watching an enormously powerful scientist at work named James James. He had wild red hair and flashing eyes, and was virtually godlike in the range and scope of his activities. James James had constructed a machine which chug-chugged and flashed radioactive particles in showers from it as it operated. Thousands of people sat about in chairs silently watching as the machine produced first an amorphous living slime and then a rough-cast baby. Then, whirling and sparking and thumping, it cast up on the floor before us all a lovely young girl, pinnacle of perfection in the cosmic process of evolution. Beside me in the dream, my wife, Rachel, rose from her seat, wishing to see better what James James had accomplished. Immediately filled with rage at her audacity in standing up, James James seized her and threw her to the floor, splintering her kneecaps and her elbows in his fury. At once I stood upright in protest. I moved down the stairs toward James James, calling on the rows of silent people to complain. There then moved into this large assembly hall men in greenish-brown khaki uniforms, on motorcycles, carrying with them as they rapidly and smoothly advanced the emblems of Rommel's Africa Corps, the sign of the palm tree. To them I croaked in hoarse appeal, "We need medical assistance." As the dream ended, the first scouts of the invading, rescuing Africa Corps heard me and turned toward me with fine, noble faces. They were dark-skinned men, rather small and delicate, a race apart from James James, with his too pale skin and bright red hair. Their eyes were large, gentle and expressive, dark. They were, I realized, the vanguard of the king. Waking up from this disturbing dream, I sat by myself in the living room. The time was about 3 a.m. and the apartment was totally silent. The dream suggested a limitation to what James James, who was Valis, could do for us, or rather would do, that his power was in fact even dangerous to us if misused. It was to the rightful king that we would have to turn for ultimate help, expressed in the dream as medical assistance, the thing we most needed in order to repair the damage done by the historical evolutionary process that the original creator James James had set in motion. The king was a correcting agent against the abuses of that temporal process. Powerful and heroic as it was, it had claimed innocent victims. Those victims, at least eventually, would be healed by the legions of the rightful king. Until he arrived, I realized, we would receive no such help. Radioactive particles, I thought. Remembering the rapid-fire emission of bits of light from James James's cosmic machine, like you find in cobalt therapy. The double-edged sword of creation. Radioactivity in the form of cobalt bombardment cures cancer, but radioactive emissions in themselves are cancer-producing. James James's cosmic machine got out of hand and injured Rachel, who stepped out of line in the sense that she stood up. That was enough to enrage the cosmic lord of creation. We need a defender as well, an advocate on our side who can intervene. Cancer, the process of creation gone wild, I thought. And then, in an instant, the AI operator transferred an explanation to my mind. I saw James James the Creator as master of all prior or efficient causes, of the deterministic process moving forward up the manifold of linear time from the first nanosecond of the universe to its last. But I also saw another creative being at the far end of the universe, at its point of completion, directing, accepting, shaping, and guiding the flow of change so that it reached the proper conclusion. This creative entity, possessing absolute wisdom, guided rather than coerced, arranged rather than created. She or it was the architect of the plan and the controller of final or teleological causes. It was as if the original creator of the universe lobbed it like a great softball on a long, blind trajectory, whereupon the receiving entity corrected its course and let it right into her glove. Without her, I realized, the great softball which was the universe, however well and hard it had been thrown, would have wandered out into left field somewhere and come to rest at some random, unpremeditated spot. This dialectic structure of the change process of the universe was something I had never glimpsed before. We had an active creator and a wise receiver of what he created. This did not fit any cosmology or theology I had ever heard of. The creator, standing before the creation, his creation, had absolute power. But from my James James dream, I could see that in a very real sense he lacked a kind of knowledge, a certain vital foresight. This was supplied by his weak but absolutely wise counterplayer at the far end. Together they performed in tandem. A god, perhaps, divided into two portions, split off from himself, so as to set up the dynamics of a kind of two-person game. Their goal was the same, however. No matter how much they might seem to conflict or work against each other, they commonly desired the successful outcome of their joint enterprise. I had no doubt, therefore, that these twin entities were manifestations of a single substance, projected to different points in time, with different attributes predominating. The first creator predominated in power, the final one in wisdom. And in addition, there was the rightful king, who at any time could breach the temporal process at some point of his selection, and with his hosts enter creation. Like cancer cells, the original constituents of the universe proliferated without direction, a total panoply of newness. Allowed to escape, they went wherever casual chains drove them. The architect, who imposed form and order and deliberate shape, was, in the cancer process, somehow missing. I had learned a great deal from my James James dream. I could see that blind creation, not subjected to pattern, could destroy. It could be a steamroller that crushed the small and helpless in its eagerness to grow. More accurately, it was like one immense living organism which spread out into all the space available to it, without regard for the consequences. It was only impelled by the drive to expand and increase. What became of it largely depended on the wise receiver, who pruned and trimmed it as each step of the growth took place. Seated on the couch by myself, I passed from a contemplation of this into a trance-like state, bordering on sleep, but not quite sleep. I was still conscious enough to be aware of myself, and to a certain extent, to think. I found myself confronting a modern-looking teletype, attached to wires that led into ultra-sophisticated electronic assemblies, far superior to anything we humans actually have. Identify yourself. I watched the words print themselves out, and as they were printed I heard the same chug-chug made by James James's radioactive cosmic machine of creation. I said, I am Nicholas Brady of Placentia, California. After a measurable pause, the teletype printed out, Sadasa Sylvia. What does that mean? I asked. Again a pause, and then again the chug-chug. But instead of seeing words printed out, I saw a snapshot. A girl with afro-natural hair, a small worried face, and glasses. The girl held a notebook and clipboard. Across the bottom of the snapshot, the teletype printed out a phone number, but I could not see it clearly enough to read it. The figures blurred. I understood that I was supposed to remember it, but there was no way I could. The transmission was arriving from too distant a transmitter. Where are you? I asked. The teletype printed out, I don't know. It seemed puzzled by the question. Evidently it was a very low order of AI entity along the network. Look around you, I told it. See if you can find something in the way of writing, an address. Obligingly, the minor AI operator searched its environment. I could sense its local activity. I have found an envelope. What's the address on it? I said. Read it. The ultramodern teletype printed out, F. Walloon, Portuguese States of America. That made no sense to me. Portuguese States of America? An alternate universe? I was as puzzled as it was, Neither of us knew where the transmission came from. And then contact broke. The teletype machine faded out, and I could no longer sense its presence. Bewildered, I woke to full consciousness. Had this interchange signified anything? Or, despite my subjective impression of lucidity, had I been totally befuddled by a dream state, altered consciousness without true rationality? Perhaps Portuguese States of America merely symbolized a long distance away, another cosmos entirely, as far away as I could imagine, not to be taken literally. I could still remember the face of the girl in the snapshot and the name Sadasa Sylvia. Perhaps the low-order AI operator had reversed it. More likely it had been intended to read Sylvia Sadasa. The name meant nothing to me. I had never heard it before. Nor had I ever seen the little worried face with its mouth turned down at the corner as if in weary depression. The phone number, plus any other data it had intended for me, was lost forever. That had not gotten through, at least not to my conscious mind. I wondered what the snapshot and name signified. No way to tell. Nothing now, no meaning at all. Perhaps in time, higher-placed operators in the AI spectrum, along the communications network, would eventually fill in the missing pieces of information and make it clear. I had already noticed that, rather than arriving in linear fashion, network printouts tended to reach me in staggered clusters, placed at random, so that no pattern could be discerned until the final and most important cluster had been transmitted. That way, the transmitter held the key segment in its possession until the last moment possible, reducing what it had previously given me to a cipher. As I returned to the bedroom, Johnny called to me from his bed.
"Daddy, can I have a drink?"
From the tap in the bathroom, I got him a glass of water, and then, in a state of half-sleep, not fully recovered from the disquieting experience with the low-level AI unit, I took a piece of bread from the kitchen. Carrying the bread and the water, I entered Johnny's room. He was sitting up, reaching grumpily for the glass of water. "Here is a game," I said. It had to be done stealthily and rapidly, because of the Romans, and it had to be done in such a manner that if they happened to see, they would understand nothing and think only that I was giving my son bread and water. Bending down, I gave him the piece of bread, and then, before he took the water, I inclined the glass playfully, as if by accident, and managed to splash it on his hair and forehead. Then, wiping it off with the sleeve of my pajama, I traced with my finger a cross of water on his forehead and said very quietly, under my breath, so that only he and I could hear, words in Greek that I did not know the meaning of. Then at once I gave him the glass of water to drink from, and as he handed it back I kissed him and hugged him, as if spontaneously. It was done in an instant, this ritual of ceremony, this series of actions, whatever it was, something ancient which I knew to do by instinct. As I let go of my son, I said into his ear, for only him to hear, "Your secret name is Paul. Remember that." Johnny gazed at me quizzically and then smiled. It was over. His real name had been given him, and under the correct circumstances. "Good night," I said aloud, and left his bedroom. Behind me, he rubbed at his moist hair and sleepily lay back in his bed. What was that all about? I asked myself. In the dream transmission, something had been freighted across to me on an unconscious level, instructions rather than information, concerning the welfare of my son. When I returned to bed, I had another dream concerning Sadasa Sylvia. I heard music as I lay in sleep. Astonishingly lovely music. A woman singing, accompanied by an acoustic guitar. Gradually, the guitar gave way to a small studio combo, and I heard then subtracks with backup vocals and the faint hint of an echo chamber. It was a professional production. I thought, we should sign her up. She's good. Presently, I found myself in my office at Progressive Records. I could still hear the girl singing, again with the solo guitar. She sang, "You have to put your slippers on to walk toward the dawn." As I listened, I picked up a new album which we had mastered. A mock-up of the artwork and layout had already been prepared. Inspecting it critically, I saw that the singer was Sadasa Sylvia. There, in addition to her name on the album cover, was her picture. The same afro-natural hairstyle, the small worried face, the glasses. There was blurb material on the back, but I could not read it. The small letters blurred away. That dream remained clear in my mind when I woke up the next morning. What a voice, I said to myself as I showered and shaved. In all my life I had never heard such a pure voice, so compelling, absolutely accurate in pitch, I realized critically. A soprano, something like Joan Baez. What we could do in the way of marketing a voice like that. Thinking about Sadassa Sylvia reawakened my concern about my job at Progressive. I had missed a lot of time. Maybe I was ready now to go back. The dream was telling me that. Think you can make out okay alone? I asked Rachel.
Is your eyesight?
I can see well enough, I said. I think it was all the vitamin C I was taking. It's finally flushed out of my system, taking everything else with it. I spent one whole day walking around Placentia, enjoying myself immensely. There was a beauty in the trash of the alleys which I had never noticed before. My vision now seemed sharpened rather than impaired. As I walked along, it seemed to me that the flattened beer cans and papers and weeds and junk mail had been arranged by the wind into patterns. These patterns, when I scrutinized them, lay distributed so as to compromise a visual language. It resembled the trail signs which I understood American Indians used. And as I walked along, I felt the invisible presence of a great spirit which had gone before me, walked here and moved the unwanted debris in these subtle, meaningful ways so as to spell out a greeting of comradeship to me, the smaller one who would follow. You can almost read this stuff, I thought to myself. But I couldn't. All I could gather from the arrangements of trash was a participation in the passage of the great figure who had preceded me. He had left these discarded objects placed so that I would know he had been there, and in addition a golden illumination lay over them, a glow that told me something about his nature. He had brought the dust out of its obscurity into a kind of light. This was a good spirit indeed. I had an acute feeling that the animals always saw this way, always were aware of who and what had passed along the alleys ahead of them. I was seeing with a hypervision associated with them. What a better world than our own, I reflected. It is so much more alive. It was not so much that I had been exalted upward from my animal nature to the realm of the transcendent. Actually, I seemed closer to the animal world, more tuned to actual matter. Perhaps this was the first time I had really been at home in the world. I accepted all I saw and enjoyed it. I did not judge. And since I did not judge, there was nothing to reject. I was ready to return to work. I felt cured. Having handled the shoe ad certainly helped. The crisis had come and gone. It did not disturb my tranquility to know that in point of fact I had not dealt with the shoe ad, but rather that it had been handled for me by unseen entities. What would have demoralized me would have been their absence, if they had let me fall, incompetent and confused, alone. My incompetence had called these invisible friends forth. Had I been more gifted, I would not now know of them. It was, in my mind, a good trade. Few people had the awareness I now possessed. Because of my limitations, an entire new universe had revealed itself to me, a benign and living hyper-environment endowed with absolute wisdom. Wow, I said to myself. You can't beat that. I'd caught a glimpse of the big people. It was a lifetime dream fulfilled. You'd have to go back to ancient times to find a comparable revelation. Things like this didn't happen in the modern world.